Welcome to the primary edition of your local talking newspaper, covering St Albans, Harpenden and all the villages within the district. You've just heard a piece of music called Seeking a Sandpiper. We hope you enjoyed listening to it. We'll be playing more of it a little later on. Our thanks go to Goffby for allowing us to use his music. Today's edition of Primary is for week ending the 7th of March 2020, and the news items come from the Hart Advertiser and the Review. Now here is my first news item. Council errors in charging for care. There is no clarity in what citizens or council should pay. A county council is among several local authorities that have been forced to pay compensation for the distress they caused by wrongly charging families for the care of their elderly and vulnerable relatives. In the last 5 years, Hertfordshire County Council was among several councils that have been criticised by a government watchdog over its poor handling of charging for care services. Between January 1, 2015 and December 31, 2019, three complaints were upheld by the local government and social care ombudsman. In one case in 2015, the county council was at fault for changing its charging policy so that it contradicted the terms of its contract with the care home. It was also at fault in not informing a man, referred to as Mr. B, of the change which affected the amount he would have to pay for his mother's respite care. Mr. B was given £303 to put matters right. A year later, another case saw the county council fail to review the financial assessment of a man referred to as Mr. X, when his wife left their jointly owned property to live in the same care home as him. This resulted in the care provider charging a higher rate of fees than it would otherwise have done. It also meant Mr. X did not receive benefits advice when he should have done. The county council offered to reduce the debt by charging the council rate of fees and also agreed to make a time and trouble payment to his daughter. In 2018, a man referred to as Mr. C complained the county council failed to disregard his aunt's property as part of her financial assessment for residential care. However, the ombudsman only found fault with regards to a delay that occurred, which did not cause a significant injustice. Hertfordshire County Council says the cases are historic in nature and were resolved at the time to the satisfaction of the ombudsman. A spokesman said, "We always support people to understand the charges they will need to pay for care and support as set out in statute. We have a team which is very experienced in these matters. Sometimes a person's circumstances are complex and determining the charge which is due can be complicated. We've recently made some changes to ensure that all staff who work in this area are skilled in all aspects of assessing what someone is required to pay and ways of paying, including options for deferring payments. When complaints arise, we investigate these carefully and ensure learning points are shared to continually improve our processes and ensure the customer is at the heart of what we do." Professor Martin Green, OBE, Chief Executive of Care England, said, "The high level of ombudsman decisions about care funding is a reflection of the fact that there is no clarity about what the citizen has to pay and what is paid for by government. Social care funding is in need of immediate reform."
Hello, it's Julia here. Council confusion over Crane leads to market disruption. St Albans traders were unable to set up their stalls in the usual way yesterday morning due to a crane blocking the entrance to the depot. The mix-up is not fully understood by the traders nor St Albans District Council, but the huge piece of machinery meant that customers and traders have lost out on a day's shopping. Head of Community Services for St Albans City and District Council, Joe Tavernier, said, "I've been out and about today at the Charter Market apologising to both the traders and their customers for our failure to put up the stalls. I've explained that this was the result of an unfortunate mix-up over access to the depot in Drover's Way where the equipment is stored. When our team turned up at 3 a.m. to begin putting up the stalls, they discovered that their tractors and trailers had been fenced off overnight. This was part of works undertaken to secure a site for a large crane that is being used for building work nearby. The crane was properly licensed by our licensing department, but somehow arrangements had not been made to ensure that we could still access our equipment. I'm investigating why that is the cause, and in the meantime I can only apologise for the disruption. Our traders have been very understanding, and I've been hugely impressed by the way many of them have improvised to keep the market going, using their own gazebos and other equipment to put up makeshift stalls. We have, of course, waived their fees today. I'm now looking to resolve the problem so that future markets will go ahead as normal. I've never known anything like this to happen before, and we will take measures to ensure that it doesn't do so again. Record store trader Tony pitched up on the pavement. If it rains today, I'll be packing up. It hasn't inconvenienced me much, really. The only detriment is to the local people. I hope they won't charge the full amount of rent. Disappointed shoppers John and Julia Freeman went to get a specific type of needle and thread from a stall which has not been able to open today due to the crane blocking the depot. John said, "There's not much here today at all. We will now have to go along to a shop on Beach Road for the sewing things my wife needs. It's very frustrating."
Hello, Susan here. Former pianist celebrates her 100th birthday. A former piano teacher celebrated her 100th birthday by enjoying a live piano performance. Beryl Leek, who lives in Field House Booper Care Home in Harpenden, celebrated her birthday with a tea party and a musical performance by her friend, musician Cuneo Hall. Beryl developed a love for music as a piano teacher and has enjoyed playing music throughout her life. No longer able to play the piano due to the arthritis in her hands, she loves reminiscing about the old days and enjoys visits from her children Liz and Richard, 5 grandchildren and great-grandson. Beryl's daughter Liz said, "It was great to share the day with Mum and see her having such a lovely time, particularly with the special performance from Cuneo." Beryl has always had a passion for music and used to love playing to us on the piano when we were younger. Having someone play her favourites, especially for her, made the occasion extra special. Born in 1920, the year the League of Nations was established, Beryl grew up in Saundersted in Surrey. She had a very happy childhood and has particularly fond memories from her holidays in Devon, where she would collect shells and go swimming in the sea. She met her husband of 65 years, Donald, when they were neighbours in Saundersted, and he offered to mend her motorbike. Events during her early life included the Wall Street crash, the rise of Hitler, the abdication of Edward VIII in 1936, and the coronation of King George VI the following year, and the outbreak of the Second World War when she was 19. During the war, Beryl studied at the Royal College of Music, graduating in 1942. She went on to teach music in Kent and helped with the Red Cross. During the war, her house was bombed and the family lost everything, but she says the family were just thankful they survived. She later moved to Cuffley in Hertfordshire, where for more than 30 years, Beryl was a rehearsal pianist with the East Hearts Operatic Society and the Cuffley Operatic Society. She moved to Field House with Donald in 2016, where the couple shared a room until he died, and there's a lovely photograph of Beryl surrounded by her family with a great big cake.
A Harpenden school building is due to open ahead of schedule. Opponents to Catherine Warrington's school in Lower Luton Road challenged its building plans, arguing it should not be sited on Greenbelt land, taking their fight all the way to the High Court. Campaign group Right School, Right Place had argued that it should not be built on the chosen site, claiming the development would cause urban sprawl between Harpenden and Wheatamstead. This delayed phase one of construction work on the new school, in which the sports centre was converted into temporary classrooms. So at the start of the autumn term, pupils had to travel to the University of Hertfordshire campus in Hatfield. However, the lost time has now been regained, and the main school building will now be open for students in the summer. Students currently educated in the repurposed sports centre will move into the new school on Monday, June the 22nd. Head teacher Tony Smith said work was due to start in December 2018, but started a month later. This delayed the completion of our temporary accommodation in the newly built sports centre and pushed the projected completion date for the main build back into the school summer holidays 2020. I'm delighted that our current staff and students will be able to familiarise themselves with the extensive facilities in advance of the next academic year, and that we'll be able to host our transition day for our New Year 7 students in the new building. The new school building and its facilities are the culmination of a lot of hard work from everyone involved, and it's absolutely fantastic to see it come together. The 50-plus new classroom facilities include 9 state-of-art science labs, 3 art rooms, CAD-CAM tech rooms with 3D and laser cutters, a vaulted drama suite, 2 music rooms, and instrument rehearsal facilities, and its own radio station. Immediately the school occupies the new building, work will commence to transform the currently repurposed sports centre, which should be ready for occupation and hire outside the school day, by the end of September. The new school, which sits on a 47-acre site, is already oversubscribed with a waiting list for this current academic year and also for its September 2020 intake.
Dáil Éireadh fares to increase this year. Fares for Hertfordshire County Council's Dáil Éireadh service will increase from April, councillors have decided. The Dáil Éireadh service offers a door-to-door service for Hertfordshire residents who are over 75 or disabled, with the fare for the journey dependent on the distance travelled. The Council's Cabinet decided on Monday that fares would increase by 20 pence for the first mile, from £1.90 to £2.10, and by 5 pence for each subsequent mile. And they also agreed that in future years, fares for the service would automatically increase in line with inflation. At the meeting, Executive Member for Adult Care and Health, Councillor Richard Roberts, said the fares had remained the same for the past 5 years since 2015. And he said the catch-up increase was the equivalent of inflationary increases over those 5 years. He said, in reality, this is playing a little bit of catch-up for Dáil Éireadh members in terms of charging, he said. So that we're having a 20p increase for the first mile and a 5p a mile thereafter just for this year, which is not a huge increase, but is playing catch-up because there hasn't been an increase since 2015. And thereafter will be CPI indexed to inflation.
Ex-England cricketer joins It's OK to Say for college session. 6 formers from a St Albans school set aside a day to focus on mental well-being as part of the HeartSad It's OK to Say awareness initiative. Students at St Columba's College were visited by the campaign's founder, Stacey Turner, and former England cricketer Monty Panesar last week, who highlighted issues around men's mental health. Pear wanted to emphasise the message that reaching out for support before things get difficult is a healthy way to be. They told the boys that if they are struggling, then speaking up and accessing practical solutions supports mental health on an everyday basis. Stacey explained, "We concentrated on strategies the boys can use to look after themselves in order to be better equipped to deal with the challenges of everyday life." She added, "Whether you're wanting to improve your daily life, have issues and pressures, or things that are spiralling, reach out. We're all human and aren't born with a manual. No two people are ever the same." The cricketer, who is a mental health ambassador for the Professional Cricketers Association, strongly reinforced the campaign's message in his speech. He spoke about the pressures he has faced on and off the cricket pitch over the years and of his passion for cricket from a young age. Catherine Treacy, head of Girton House at the school, said it was so important for them to be reminded of the need to speak up if they are struggling. The students really enjoyed hearing about Monty's career and how he and his colleagues manage the professional pressures. "The practical solutions that you provided to support the boys' mental health were excellent, and they found them really practical. Monty's clarity on the demands of real ambition and guidance on how to keep strong against distractions at this age was particularly inspiring and thought-provoking." Head boy Gus McMahon added, "When It's OK to Say visited our school, it was their open and genuine attitude that allowed us to engage and interact freely with a topic which still bears much stigma today. We were treated like equals, and there was no sense of it being a lecture. It was, to us, simply an informative and productive discussion. I personally feel much better just knowing that there are people like those at It's OK to Say who will always be there for us. And there's a lovely picture of the students and Monty Panesar and Stacey Turner at St Columba's College.
Cathedral volunteer wins award for efforts. A St Albans man has been recognised for his exceptional service to the UK's heritage sector following 40 years of volunteer work at St Albans Cathedral. Stephen De Silva won Ecclesiastical's Heritage Hero Lifetime Award on Wednesday, February the 26th, at an event hosted at the Tower of London. The award, which was sponsored by a specialist insurer, Ecclesiastical, celebrates Stephen's dedicated and transformative volunteering efforts for the cathedral during the past 40 years. From coordinating the launch of a new exhibition in order to bring more visitors, to fundraising to future-proof the cathedral, this award celebrates the many hours Stephen has volunteered. Stephen De Silva said, "Meeting our visitors and working with the staff at St Albans Cathedral has enriched my life in countless ways. Being a heritage hero is the icing on the cake. Thank you so much for recognising the work of volunteers. We're often at the heart of so many great heritage sites." Peter Ainsworth, chair of the Heritage Alliance and Faith Kitchen Heritage Director at Ecclesiastical, presented the award. Stephen received a framed, original, Pugin-designed tile from the Palace of Westminster as a token of gratitude. The award ceremony coincided with Heritage Day, the key event in the heritage sector calendar, with speakers including Sir Tim Lawrence, Chair of English Heritage and the Minister for Arts, Heritage and Tourism. Faith Kitchen said, "As the leading insurer of Grade 1 listed buildings in the UK, we're passionate about Britain's heritage. We're proud to sponsor the Heritage Heroes Awards, and this year celebrates two incredibly deserving winners for their outstanding contribution to the heritage sector." Well, congratulations, Stephen. Peter Ainsworth added, "A true heritage hero is a person who generously gives time and knowledge to creating and preserving beautiful places and objects, often under the radar, for the benefit of everyone. They make a huge contribution to their community by making local places and stories more loved and accessible. Stephen is a true inspiration." And the article is accompanied by a photograph of Peter Ainsworth, who is chair of Heritage Alliance, Stephen De Silva, and Faith Kitchen. She is Heritage Director at Ecclesiastical.
Rotary Club urges people to take the plunge for mental health charity. A St Albans swimathon is raising money for people with mental ill health. People from across the district are being invited to take part in a Rotary swimathon in aid of mental health charity Mind in Mid Hearts. The swimathon at Westminster Lodge Leisure Centre is on Saturday from 6 p.m. to 10 p.m. The fundraising event is in its second year, with last year's swimathon raising nearly £12,000 for homeless charity Hearts Young Homeless. As research has shown, one in four people will experience mental health issues. The charity supports those suffering from poor mental health through workshops, therapy sessions, outdoor and indoor activities, telephone support lines, and NHS staff training. At any given time, Mind in Mid Hearts engaged with around 500 people. The swimathon will be raising funds to provide additional resources to cope with the increasing demand for their services. The event is free to take part in, and participants can enter individually or in teams of up to six. It's a fantastic opportunity for members of the public to challenge themselves in aid of a crucial organisation. Last year, a 65-year-old swam out of his depth for the first time since nearly drowning at the age of 18. Through his bravery, he raised £3,000 in donations alone. This year, an 89-year-old blind man is planning to take to the water again. After once swimming the channel before he was blinded during the Mau Mau uprising in 1950s, General Manager Leslie Garner said, "Absolutely thrilled to be hosting our Rotary Swimathon for the second year running. What better way to work together and make a splash in a bid to improve our community's mental health?" This year, we're challenging ourselves to beat last year's record and raise even more money. Whether you're an avid swimmer or just a beginner, it doesn't matter. Everyone's welcome to get involved and show your support. It's open to people of all ages and abilities. And there's a brilliant photograph of a gentleman in swimming trunks with three ladies fully clothed.
Taking a walk through history, this is an article by Marissa Laycock, who moved to St Albans in the year 2000, and she enjoys sharing her experiences of living in the city. I begin my walk into Romeland and wander down Fishbourne Street, which turns towards St Michael's Village. Its elevated pavements and numerous former coaching inns remind me that it is one of the oldest roads in the city and one of the stops on the principal medieval routes in and out of St Albans to London. According to antique maps, St Albans originally grew up around the north, east and west sides of the Abbey, extending around the Marketplace, along St Peter Street, Holywell Street, High Street and Fishpool Street, all of which apparently existed by the 11th century. With such a long and varied history, I'm not at all surprised that this city is a source of pride and enjoyment to its residents and attracts so many visitors. This historic district is very picturesque, and even on a cloudy day, the red brick and flower baskets that hang from the timber frames exude a warmth and brightness. Many buildings date from the 16th and 17th centuries, and there is still an intricate mix of Georgian, Tudor, neoclassical and Victorian architecture. By the end of the 60s, it had become a conservation area with over 70 listed buildings, a phenomenally high concentration in a single street. I absorb the old-world charm of the rows of snug cottages, only two floors high, and freshly painted in white, the doorways and brightly decorated front doors in unique colours with shiny door knockers and letterboxes, each one exuding its own distinctive character. Originally, Fishpool Street is believed to owe its name to fish ponds, which provided a livelihood for the Saxon residents of Kingsbury. It follows the higher ground on the north bank of the River Ver. Always a very busy street, there were once several straw hat-making factories dating from the 17th century, with many shops and as many as 14 pubs in the street, offering good beer and a welcoming atmosphere. One of St Albans' 40 war memorials is situated here, recording the names of residents killed in the First World War. Described as one of the main jewels in the crown of St Albans and given its proximity to Verulamium Park, the cathedral and River Ver, makes it the perfect setting. Huge cedar trees in the distance create an attractive vista from St Michael's Churchyard. Further down the street is St Michael's Manor Hotel, a stately manor house dating back to the 1500s. Overlooking a tranquil lake with 5 acres of beautiful manicured gardens. Apparently it has a ceiling that dates from Elizabethan times and is the perfect location for a wedding or to impress your guests with an afternoon tea. The Lower Red Lion Pub, the only remaining pub on the street, sells real ale, holds weekly quiz nights and even bed and breakfast, its main building dating back to the 17th century. Strangely, there are no turnings out of Fishbourne Street. I don't think I'd like to meander home at night all alone after a pint or two through this apparently haunted thoroughfare. Although I wouldn't mind waking up in this location and looking out into the magnificence of the Abbey while enjoying breakfast in bed. I'd love to go on a historic city guided tour to find out more about the scandals and sinister events that took place over the centuries within this old street, documented to be here since the mid-1200s. The question remains, how did this street, so steeped in history and once a major coaching route up to the 18th century, gradually degenerated into a 19th century slum before transforming into the fashionable and prime residential area that we see today?
Man guilty of racial assault. A young man who hurled anti-Semitic abuse at a Jewish family in St Albans city centre has been found guilty of racially aggravated assault. A video clip of Adam Cassidy, 20, of St Albans, calling a family dirty Jews and kicking and advertising hoarding towards them outside Costa Coffee in St Peter Street went viral in August last year. St Albans Magistrates Court heard this week that Cassidy called the group dirty Jews when they confronted him after he collided with a baby buggy. Cassidy claimed they called him a dirty Arab first, but his defence was rejected by magistrates. A video of the incident, filmed by victim Michael Mendelssohn, was played to the court and showed Cassidy using the anti-Semitic term three times before kicking a Costa hoarding in the family's direction. Cassidy, who grew up in Egypt and is the son of an English mother and a Turkish father, had pleaded not guilty to racially aggravated assault and to using the slur when he appeared in court. But District Judge Margaret Dodd found Cassidy guilty of two charges of racially aggravated assault. She told Cassidy, "I don't accept your evidence. I don't accept anybody called you anything. Whether it was an accident when you bumped into the buggy, I don't know. That doesn't excuse what you did. I'm satisfied you used the language and you used it more than once. I don't accept it was mere abuse. There are plenty of words you could have used if you just wanted to be rude. This was motivated by a racial motive. It was obvious that they were Jewish because of their skull caps, and for that reason, you said dirty Jew three times. I don't accept that you were fearing that you would be attacked when you kicked the barrier. I'm not sure what you were trying to do, but Mr. Mendelssohn would have been hit by the barrier that you agreed you kicked deliberately." Speaking after the hearing, Mr. Mendelssohn, who filmed the tirade of abuse, said Cassidy's defence added insult to injury. "It's upsetting that this kind of behaviour happens in this day and age, and Cassidy will be sentenced next month."
Masayoki Band will be headlining 2020 Festival on the Field. Harpenden's award-winning, family-friendly festival is back again this summer. Festival on the Field will be taking place on Saturday, 4th of July, on the St. John Laws School playing field. The lively event is packed with fantastic live music from local artists to top tribute acts. Headlining this year and backed by popular demand is the much sought-after mass karaoke band, Masayoki. They took the festival by storm in 2018 with the almost 3,000-strong crowd singing their hearts out along with the band, as well as a range of food and drinks on offer. The ever-popular fairground will also be back with a greater range of attractions. This is the fifth time around for Harpenden's largest outdoor music event. The previous four festivals raised over £90,000 for Man Land and Sir John Laws Schools, all Harpenden schools benefiting from a cashback scheme on tickets they sell. There will be three further tribute acts, and a trio of local bands will start the festival off. The whole thing will open with an hour's entertainment from Man Land and Sir John Laws Schools student performers from 12:30 to 1:30. The full programme will be announced in the next few weeks. The festival will also be showing the Euro 2020 Games on a big screen, so you can come along and enjoy the music without missing a minute of the football. Mark Hill, one of the show's original organisers, said, "Not only have we rebooked Masayoki this year following their huge success at the festival in 2018, we've also got a great series of top-quality tribute bands lined up. They will be supported by some wonderful local talent." The festival's fantastic fairground will also be returning to keep the younger festival goers amused. The festival is looking for more sponsors to come on board, alongside Easy Serve, Saudi Rec Gymnastics Club and the Harpenden Collective. Tickets go on general release from Saturday, March the 14th.
New town leisure and cultural centres moving closer to opening. Work on a state-of-the-art leisure and culture facility for Harpenden is moving ahead, and sections should be opening sooner than anticipated. The £18.8 million District Council project will create leisure and cultural centres in Rothamsted Park. The existing swimming pool building is being extended and turned into a leisure centre, while the old sports centre is being converted into a cultural hub. The leisure centre was due to open next January, but progress has been faster than expected and is now likely to open before the end of this year. It will include a wide range of enhanced facilities such as an improved gym, a new cafe, sports hall, sauna, steam room, learner pool and refurbished main pool. The cultural centre replacing the ageing Harpenden Public Halls in Southdown Road will include a 511-seat theatre, two function rooms, an exhibition space, bars on two floors and a cafe overlooking the park. Unexpectedly, the lower roof of the existing sports centre will now need to be replaced instead of being retained after issues with its design and the materials used came to light in a report issued by a government safety body. Structural engineers had previously said the existing roof could support a required increase in mechanical plant if it was strengthened. Now they have advised, following the new safety guidance, that this is no longer the case. This extra work will impact the construction timetable so that the cultural centre will now likely open next May, a few weeks later than originally envisaged. Sports centre users are being offered alternative facilities while the building is closed, and creche members will be able to use a creche at Batchwood Sports Centre from next Monday. The exercise studio will close on the evening of March the 13th and be relocated to the South Down Room of Harpenden Public Halls. The gym will shut on March the 19th and reopen the following Monday in the vacated exercise studio and creche. Councillor Robert Donald, portfolio holder for commercial and development, said, "The good news is that these arrangements will only be in place for a short time and that the new multi-sports leisure centre is now on course to be opened ahead of schedule later this year instead of early in 2021, despite the construction programme changes."
Coronavirus case at town surgery. The surgery at the centre of the district's first case of coronavirus has been praised for its speedy response. Davenport House Surgery in Harpenden confirmed a patient who recently tested positive for COVID-19 had visited the Bowers Way premises on the evening of Tuesday, February 25, prior to their diagnosis. A statement said the practice was informed on Sunday the 1st of March and took all appropriate precautionary measures on the advice of Public Health England. This included Public Health England contacting the very small number of patients who were on the premises at the time, and they recommend the surgery was deep cleaned. This took place on the same day, which allowed the practice to fully open as usual on Monday the 2nd of March. "We've been praised by the CCG for our speedy response to implementing our business continuity plan and arranging for cleaning of the practice premises, which assisted in minimising disruption for our patients." An NHS Harts Valleys Clinical Commissioning Group, that's the CCG, spokesperson confirmed the practice has taken all appropriate precautionary measures as advised by experts at Public Health England.
Question of Sport charity dinner hits fundraising gold. A staggering 250 guests from businesses across the area pitted their wits against each other at Rennie Grove's 7th annual Question of Sport charity dinner. The event took place at Sopwell House and was hosted by Sky Sports presenter, St Albans resident and long-term Rennie Grove supporter Jeff Shreves. The fiercely fought quiz was eventually won by investment management company Close Brothers. Tracy Hancock, director of fundraising at Rennie Grove, said, "It was a fabulous event and we're delighted that a staggering £50,000 was raised during the evening to support the important services we provide for local adults and children. I would like to thank our sponsors and all those who came along and helped make the night such a success, as well as our wonderful speakers for inspiring everyone in the room. This sort of support from local businesses is so vital if we're to meet our fundraising targets every year. And we're very grateful." There are three photographs. The host, Jeff Shreves, and the winning team, Close Brothers, and volunteers from Red Door Recruitment who helped make the night a success.
Green energy facility is being considered for St Albans area. Investment in a green energy generation and storage facility near St Albans is being considered by the County Council. Purpose-built facility could provide clean, green power for up to 11,000 homes and although the proposals are at an early stage, it was highlighted at a recent meeting of the full council as councillors agreed the budget for 2019-2020. Councillor Ralph Sangster, executive member for Resources and Performance, said the investment was being considered as part of the County Council's new energy strategy. He said the County Council recognised it had a pivotal role in addressing climate change. And he said the new facility could provide green power for almost one in six homes across the St Albans district. In addition, he said it would bring in an income to the County Council and would support its drive for the County Council estate to be carbon neutral by 2025. But he stressed that the plans for the facility were in the early stages of assessment. In presenting the overall budget proposals, Councillor Sangster also pointed to funding that had been set aside for the Council's sustainability strategy and to implement environmental policy initiatives. But Liberal Democrat Councillor Sandy Walkington said the Council was being timid, likening the Council's approach to the Titanic drifting towards the icebergs. St Albans District Councillor Simon Grover, leader of the local Green Party, welcomed the scheme and urged the district to follow this lead. He said after the meeting, "It's great that the County Council is finally waking up to the opportunity of investing in renewable energy. Many other councils are already doing this, and the reasons are clear. Not only does it provide a new income stream, but it can be very significantly reduce carbon emissions for the local area. Unfortunately, St Albans District Council has chosen to sink £18 million into a risky property deal in Harpenden. I have urged them to invest that money into renewable energy instead, as the economic and environmental return would be huge."
The following people were born in the past during the week commencing 8th of March. On the 8th, 1945, Mickey DeLenz of the Monkees. On the 9th, in 1910, American composer Samuel Barber. In 1918, American mystery writer Mickey Spillane. In 1934, first man into space, Yuri Gagarin. On the 10th, in 1958, American actress Sharon Stone. In 1964, His Royal Highness Prince Edward. On the 11th, in 1819, one half of Tate and Amp, Lyle. English sugar producer Henry Tate, who also gave us the first Tate Gallery. In 1885, world land and water speed record holder Malcolm Campbell. In 1952, English author of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, Douglas Adams. In 1710, composer of Rule Britannia, Thomas Arne. In 1946, American actress and singer Liza Minnelli. On 13th, in 1933, English theologian, philosopher, chemist, grammarian, and liberal political theorist Joseph Priestley. In 1939, American singer and songwriter Neil Sedaka. On the 14th, in 1820, the first king of a united Italy, Victor Emmanuel II. In 1879, German-born theoretical physicist and Nobel laureate Albert Einstein. In 1933, English actor Maurice Micklewhite, a.k.a. Michael Caine. In 1956, British javelin thrower, Olympic gold medal winner Tessa Sanderson.
This week also sees the following anniversaries in history. In 1796, Napoleon Bonaparte married Josephine, or Rose as she was then. In 1812, Robert Scott made the final diary entry of his tragic mission to reach the South Pole. In 1817, the New York Stock Exchange was founded. In 1871, England played Scotland in the first ever international rugby match. In 1884, the siege of Khartoum by the forces of the Mahdi began. In 1889, the Eiffel Tower was opened to the public. In 1917, the Russian Revolution began. Because of a difference in their calendar, it was known as the February Revolution. In 1920, the Home Rule Act was passed by the British Parliament, dividing Ireland into two parts. It was rejected by the southern counties. In 1945, world-famous diarist Anne Frank died. In 1959, Barbie made her debut at the American Toy Fair in New York. In 1963, Hitchcock's The Birds was released. In 1974, the Terracotta Army was discovered in China. In 2004, Ireland became the first country in the world to ban smoking in all workplaces.
Here are my choices for the week, and we begin with those programmes serialised from Monday to Friday. The book of the week, 9:45 a.m. on Radio 4 and repeated at 12:30 p.m, is The Peregrine by J.A. Baker, read by David Attenborough. This nature classic, written in the form of a diary, charts the peregrine's hunting life. The drama serial at 10:45 a.m. on Radio 4 is the continuation from last week of The Leopard by Giuseppe di Lampedusa. The composer of the week at noon on Radio 3 is Beethoven at home. The Call of the Wild by Jack London, read by Kerry Shale, is this week's novel, 12:04 p.m. and repeated at 10:45 p.m. It's set during the 1890s Klondike Gold Rush. Living National Treasures is at 1:45 p.m. on Radio 4. These are the stories of practitioners of unusual crafts. The Book of Strange New Things continues from last week at 7:45 p.m. on Radio 4. The Full Works concert at 8 p.m. on Classic FM brings you 2 hours of well-loved classics. Radio 4 Extra at 8 p.m. has a dramatisation of a Hercule Poirot mystery, Mrs. McGinty's Dead. And now for individual programmes, beginning on Saturday the 7th of March with a drama at 3 p.m. on Radio 4, The Turn of the Screw, The Haunting Story by Henry James. Opera on 3 at 6:30 p.m. on Radio 3 is Mozart's Così fan tutti, recorded at the Metropolitan Opera House, New York. While on Radio 4 Extra at 7 p.m, The Lives and Work of Somerset Maugham profiles the work of the successful novelist, playwright and short story writer. Archive on 4 at 8 p.m. on Radio 4 this week looks at Call Up, the story of national service 60 years after the last conscripts arrived at the barracks. Paper Cuts at 9 p.m. on Radio 2 invites retired rugby star Gareth Thomas to discuss his life and career as part of BBC Sports Relief. Your listing day on Sunday the 8th of March could begin at 3 p.m. on Radio 4, with the conclusion of The Palliser's, Anthony Trollope's drama of high life and low politics during the 1860s and 70s. More Victorian drama, this time on Radio 4 Extra, with a real-life crime, Madeline, the 1857 trial for murder of Madeline Smith. A gentler programme can be found at 4:30 p.m. on Radio 4, when in Conversations on a Bench, Anna Scott Brown chats with people who sit beside her on a bench in a park in Leeds. In Words and Music on Radio 3 at 5:30 p.m, the subject is Goddesses and Monsters, an exploration of sacred and profane women. James Taylor's Great American Songbook is at 9 p.m. on Radio 2. The folk and rock star examines the enduring appeal of standards illustrated by songs from Billie Holiday, Ray Charles and Nina Simone, amongst others.
For Monday, March the 9th, This Thing of Darkness is the drama at 2:15 on Radio 4, in which a forensic psychologist charts the psychological impact on the family of a man held in custody for the murder of his son. Three contrasting programmes follow immediately. Still on Radio 4, first at 3 p.m. is Round Britain Quiz, when you can test your deductive powers against the contestants. Then, at 3:30, the food programme examines the great Cornish pasty. This is followed at 4 p.m. by one of those wonderful Radio 4 oddities, Lift Going Up, a cultural history of the elevator, when you will step inside the lift and it will tell you its story. If you haven't discovered yet Nature Table, which is at 6:30 p.m. on Radio 4, may I recommend it to you. A variety of guests from the worlds of comedy and natural history celebrate and promote the importance of flora and fauna and share amazing facts and stories about nature. Ceres Matthews' Blues Show is at 9 p.m. on Radio 2, featuring the full spectrum of the genre. The Art of Now at 11:30 a.m. on Radio 4 kicks off our listening on Tuesday the 10th of March. When in, Good Vibrations, Issy Sooty explores the world of sound therapy. Brave Old World is the 2:15 drama on Radio 4 in the Dangerous Visions series. After an eco-disaster, one of the survivors decides to find out what the old world had to offer. At 3 p.m. on Radio 4, in Josie Long's Shortcuts, this week's adventure in sound considers phones. Some vintage comedy is on offer on Radio 4 Extra, starting at 7 p.m. with The Goon Show, followed at 7:30 p.m. by Round the Horn. Over on Radio 2 at 9 p.m, Jamie Callum presents The Jazz Show. New Weird Britain at 9:30 p.m. on Radio 4. This week goes in search of musicians blossoming in the margins in Britain. We go over to France on Wednesday, 11th of March, when at 11 a.m. on Radio 4, Le Divide, or Le Divide, I don't know, examines those three great French concepts, liberty, equality and fraternity, starting this week with liberty. In the Dangerous Visions series at 2:15 on Radio 4, the first of three plays this week, Body Horror, follows a mortician who has a full body transplant. Afternoon Concert on Radio 3 at 2 p.m. plays works by Rodrigo, Tchaikovsky and Mussorgsky. At 6:30 p.m. on Radio 4, Mark Watson describes himself as the comedian your mother likes, talks a bit about life. The Folk Show with Mark Radcliffe is at 9 p.m. on Radio 2.
Thursday the 12th of March brings us The Dystopian Thriller at 2:15 on Radio 4. Body Horror continues the story of Caroline, who has had a body transplant. She hears a voice in her head and feels the shadows left by the former inhabitant. After that, Ramblings at 3 o'clock on Radio 4. Brings a breath of fresh air when Claire Balding examines the impact that walking in nature can have on our inner lives. Two old favourites can be heard on Radio 4 Extra, starting at 7 p.m. with The Ken Dodd Show, and at 7:30 p.m, I'm Sorry, I'll Read That Again. Still on Radio 4 Extra at 8:30 p.m, an intriguing title, The Tudor Tarantino, charts the rise and fall of the dramatist Thomas Middleton, the bad boy of Renaissance drama. Bob Harris hosts The Country Show at 9 p.m. on Radio 2. Friday the 13th of March brings Forum Internum at 11 a.m. on Radio 4, when Helena Kennedy asks whether the law can protect our freedom to think from new technologies and their misuse by corporations and the state. The final part of Body Horror, this dystopian psychological thriller, is at 2:15 on Radio 4. As part of Sport Relief at 4 p.m. on Radio 3 in Beat Beethoven, participants attempt to run 5 kilometres in the time it takes to listen to Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. It normally lasts between 30 and 35 minutes. This is followed at 5 o'clock by Beat Beethoven, the after party, when music associated with sport will be played. The Now Show at 6:30 p.m. on Radio 4 presents a satirical look at the week's news. Radio 4 Extra once again has an evening of contrasts, starting at 7 o'clock with The Birkis Way, followed at 7:30 p.m. by Flywheel, Shyster and Flywheel. If you have been following Hercule Poirot's Solving the Mystery of Mrs. McGinty's Death, this is at 8 p.m. And then a delightful 30 minutes with our national treasure, Alan Bennett, talking about his boyhood visits to hear the Yorkshire Symphony Orchestra. 8 o'clock on Radio 2 is, as ever, Music Night. This time, Bruno Tonioli shares his love of operatic arias and popular works such as O Sole Mio. Asa Briggs is the subject of The Last Victorian Improver at 9 o'clock on Radio 4, which profiles the historian who, from humble beginnings, became the historian of the BBC, one of the founders of Sussex University, and played a major role on the Open University. I hope this eclectic choice brings you many happy hours of listening.
sound.
This is the current advice that the National Health Service is giving about COVID-19, commonly called coronavirus. It's a new illness that can affect your lungs and airways, and it's caused by a virus called coronavirus. The UK chief medical officers have raised the risk to the public from low to moderate. Health professionals are working to contact anyone who's been in close contact with people who have coronavirus. There are some countries and areas where there's a higher chance of coming into contact with someone with coronavirus. Details on this and other questions and answers relating to COVID-19 can be found via the front page of the NHS website at www.nhs.uk. The symptoms of coronavirus are a cough, a high temperature, and shortness of breath. But these symptoms do not necessarily mean you have the illness. The symptoms are similar to other illnesses that are much more common, such as a cold and flu. Because it's a new illness, medical scientists don't know exactly how coronavirus spreads from person to person. Similar viruses are spread in cough droplets. It's very unlikely it can spread through things like packages or food. Viruses like coronavirus cannot live outside the body for very long. Most people can continue to go to work, school, and other public places. You only need to stay away from public places, self-isolate, if advised to by the 111 online coronavirus service or a medical professional. There are things you can do to help stop viruses like coronavirus spreading. Cover your mouth and nose with a tissue or your sleeve, not your hands, when you cough or sneeze. Put used tissues in the bin immediately. Wash your hands with soap and water often. Use hand sanitizer gel if soap and water are not available. Try to avoid close contact with people who are unwell. Do not touch your eyes, nose or mouth if your hands are not clean. NHS 111 has an online coronavirus service that can tell you if you need medical help and advice and what to do. Use this service if you think you might have coronavirus, if you've recently been in a country or area with a high risk of coronavirus, if you've been in close contact with someone with coronavirus. If you feel you need assistance, do not go to a GP surgery, pharmacy or hospital. Instead, if you need to speak to someone and you live in England, call 111. If you live in Scotland, phone your GP surgery or call 111 if your surgery is not open. If you live in Wales, call 111 if available in your area or call 0845 4647. That's 0845 4647. If you live in Northern Ireland, call 0300 200 7885. That's 0300 200 7885. If there's a chance you could have coronavirus, you may be asked to stay away from other people, to self-isolate. This means you should stay at home, not go to work, school or public places, not use public transport or taxis, ask friends, family members or delivery services to do errands for you. Try to avoid visitors to your home, but it's okay for friends, family or delivery drivers to drop off food. You may need to do this for up to 14 days to help reduce the possible spread of infection. There is currently no specific treatment for coronavirus. Antibiotics do not help, as they don't work against viruses. Treatment aims to relieve the symptoms while your body fights the illness. You'll need to stay in isolation away from other people until you've recovered. Further information about COVID-19, coronavirus, is available from the NHS website at www.nhs.uk. That's www.nhs.uk. And again, if you feel you may have the virus, do not visit your local GP surgery, pharmacy or hospital. Instead, dial 111. Or phone your GP surgery.
InfoSound.
This is Rupert Evershed reading my monthly nature notes for the Hearts ad. Finding treasure in the wastelands. One of the great delights of walking with wildlife in mind is the expectation of the unexpected. It's a continual treasure hunt filled with the familiarity of the regular encounters, the reassurance of seasonal returns, and then, every now and again, something unexpected, a little find that rewards and, of course, reinvigorates the hunt and the hunter. This winter, perhaps because of its mildness, I've encountered one of those little treasures so often that I've almost come to expect it. The treasure in question is a little bird called the stonechat, not much bigger than a wren, but closer in lineage and behaviour to a robin. These little birds visit us in the winter, and while they have very occasionally bred in Harts, they are more often found in moorland and coastal scrub. Unsurprisingly, the birds that I have come across this winter have all been in areas of rough grassland and weed, with thick hedges and bramble patches not too far away for cover. My most recent encounter was of three birds as I cycled along a track next to the M25 near London Coney. The grassy embankment below the motorway above me extended into a strip of rough grass and scrub that immediately had me scanning for stonechats. However, it was not until I had got to the end of that section that I looked back and saw a little bird fly up onto a bush. I knew immediately it was a stonechat, even before raising my binoculars, simply because that is what stonechats do. These little birds are a constant movement of short forays down to the ground, followed by a quick flutter up to the nearest, most prominent stalk or bush. Fences are ideal, and stonechats will work their way along, down and up, snatching a grub or two off the ground, and then returning to the fence post or wire. Their whole world exists in an imaginary 4-foot-high layer of airspace just above the ground. In this, they will feed, breed, and rest. Only in the spring have I seen stonechats break this invisible ceiling and perch high on telegraph wires to sing their rattling but nevertheless musical tunes. The rest of the year, they live up to their name, only issuing worried contact calls that sound just like two stones being scraped and tapped together, perhaps reminiscent of slipping scree on their moorland breeding grounds. Stonechats, despite their size, are easy to see thanks to their constant movement, and while they are wary of danger, it is not the fear-filled panic of some birds. Rather, they maintain a measured adherence to a set distance from the observer of about 15 to 20 yards. Watching them, you know they have clocked your presence, but their down-and-up feeding routine does not miss a beat. I'm always reluctant to anthropomorphise, but these little birds are cute and give off a friendly vibe. However many times I chance upon them, I shall never tire of them. To me, they embody that subtle, unassuming part of nature that we can so easily overlook. They are little birds that have learnt to survive in the margins of our tidy world. If the M25 embankment had been mown, they would not be there. But as it is, the noisy motorway verge is too unattractive to us humans for it to warrant more than a cursory level of management. As with so much of our wildlife, finding stonechats often requires that we first find a place that we, as humans, have overlooked or forgotten about. A place where what the author Benedict MacDonald calls our ecological tidiness disorder has not wreaked havoc. Maybe in the areas that we ourselves have control over, however small, we would do well to exercise an ecological untidiness order and ease the reins on mowing, flailing and tidying. It should come as no surprise that areas where untidiness has been deliberately maintained, you have the best chance of finding stonechats. Hartwood Forest and Ellenbrook Fields on the edge of St Albans are perhaps the best examples. In these places, treasure is still to be found, not least stonechats.
Right, this is Peter Burley bringing you a preview of events, and that'll be from mid-March to mid-April 2020. I hope I can bring you a forecast that it will stop raining by then, but I'm not optimistic. It's about as cold and wet as it gets coming into this recording. Well, let's get on to the music, and we will start in the cathedral. And on Wednesday, the 18th of March at 12:30 p.m, we have a free organ recital with a retiring collection by Mark Brayfield from Dorking. Then we have another lunchtime event. That's on Saturday, the 21st of March at 1 p.m. And this one is a choral recital. It's the Harmonaires Choir performing, as I say, a lunchtime recital. Now, we have a big concert coming up on Saturday, the 28th of March. And that's going to be Rossini's Stabat Mater Vaughan Williams's Serenade to Music and Mendelssohn's The Hebrides Overture. And that's going to be performed by the St Albans Bach Choir, supported by the Sinfonia Verdi. Tickets for that start at £30 and work their way down to £13. And there's a concession, but they don't say how much it is, even off the £13 seats. And then lastly, we've got an organ recital on Sunday, the 5th of April at 3 p.m. And that is being given by Marco Sever, who is an organ scholar from the cathedral. Just a reminder that the Easter weekend is the 10th to the 13th of April, so there'll be quite a few events going on to do with Easter on the weeks bracketing that. Now, very different style. Let's go to the jazz club. We have three concerts. There may be more, but I haven't got the programme. The three concerts I've got notice of are 15th of March, Clark Tracy in a tribute to Miles Davis. 22nd of March, John Etheridge, who is a solo guitarist. And 29th of March, the Terry Seabrook Quintet, who will be celebrating Wayne Shorter. Now, all of these are in the Maltings. They all start at 7 p.m. and they all cost £14 or £12. Now, we've only got two concerts at St Peter's, I suspect because of the Easter period. The first is on the 18th of March with Robert Milner, who is singing, accompanied by Peter Jones on the piano. 25th of March, St Margaret's School is giving a recital, and they're all at 1 p.m. Now, the St Albans Chamber Opera are performing The Merry Widow by Franz Lehár, and that's going to be performed in the Abbey Theatre, and it runs from Wednesday the 18th to Saturday the 21st of March. Performances are at 7:30 p.m. on each of those days, but there's also a Saturday matinee at 2:30. On the 18th, it's a gala night, it says, and you will get a free glass of wine and a canapé. Tickets for that are one single price for everything, £22.50. Now, we've got another organ recital on Saturday the 21st of March. This one's in St Saviour's Church, and it's at 5:30 p.m, and it's Joseph Fort on the organ and Rosalind Ventris on the viola. They'll be performing works, in fact, entirely by J.S. Bach. Admission is free, but you will be expected to give to a retiring collection. And we have the Lee Singers, who are giving a concert called Vivaldi Squared. And I think there's a clue in the title about what sort of music it'll be. That's going to be in St Nicholas Church, which is Church Green, Harpenden, because I got them mixed up before. So St Nicholas Church, Saturday the 21st of March, starting at 7:30 p.m. And at 7:30, BBC Baroque expert Lindsay Kemp will give a short talk to set the scene for the concert and the music. Tickets for that are £15 or £7 concessionary tickets. Now, although it's a Vivaldi concert, in fact, there's going to be music also by Bach and Monteverdi. And the Harding Choir are performing a concert called The Earthly Rose. And that's going to be, this is a clash, it's going to be at exactly the same time, Saturday the 21st of March, 7:30 p.m. But this time it's in the High Street Methodist Church in Harpenden. And they're performing Fauré's Requiem, Fauré's Cantique de Jean Racine, and Vaughan Williams's five variants of Dives and Lazarus. Now, tickets for that are unreserved £14, free if you're under 16, and say that's in the Methodist Church. There's another one, Saturday the 21st of March, 7:30 p.m. This time it's in St Peter's Church, and it's the Carillion Chamber Choir, and they'll be performing Seven Last Words by Joseph Haydn. Now, tickets for that are £15 or £13 concessionary tickets. Right, well, we've finally broken free of the 21st of March because the Harpenden Choral Society will be performing on Saturday the 28th of March at 7:30 p.m. And they'll be in St Nicholas Church, Harpenden, which is the one we've just previewed on the green. And they're performing just one piece of music, the Dvorak Requiem, and they're supported by the King's Sinfonietta and some soloists. Tickets for that are £15 for adults, £5 if you're a student. It doesn't say if there are other concessionary tickets, but you will get an interval drink with your ticket. Now, our last concert is by Voix de Vivre, a French group, and they're performing a concert on Saturday the 4th of April at 7:30 p.m. in St Peter's Church, in St Peter's Street, St Albans, obviously, and it's called Steps of the Sun, and it's music of the changing seasons. And include The Passing of the Year by Dove, and May Magnificat by Matthias, and Der Abend by Strauss, with other works by Haydn, Beethoven, Schumann and Schubert. Tickets for that are £15 or OAP's £13. Now, over at the arena, we kick off with the Circus of Horrors. And it's a new Circus of Horrors. It's an immersive celebration of all that's astounding in this particular style of performance. That's on Sunday the 15th of March at 7:30pm. Tickets are £26 or £23 or £22 or £20. Quite sure. I presume the cheaper ones are in the balcony. Wednesday the 18th of March, 7:30pm, we have a performance of Aida, and it's given by the Russian State Opera, and it's obviously Verdi's opera. I don't think it needs any great previewing from me, except to tell you, so Wednesday the 18th, 7:30pm, tickets £35 or £32. Then we have on Friday the 20th of March, 7:30pm, The Sound of Springsteen, and this is a tribute concert. Tickets to hear the tribute to him are going to be £24 or £22.50. Ah, then we have Eric and Ern, another tribute show, obviously, and that's a wonderful double act. Good show for all the family from 8 to 108, it says. Saturday the 21st of March, 8pm, all tickets £22.50. Then we have the Talking Pictures TV and Renown Pictures 7th Festival of Film. This is a festival celebrating TV and film music. It's on Sunday the 22nd of March, and it's an all-day event. So get there at 10 in the morning, and you finish at 7 in the evening. Then we have Sir Ranulph Fiennes giving a one-man show, and he'll be talking to you on Monday the 23rd of March at 7:30pm. Tickets are £26.50. There is a concessionary price, but they haven't said what it is. Wednesday the 25th of March, 7:30pm, we have an evening with Sir Geoff Hurst, and that will cost you £25, no concessions. Friday the 27th of March, 7:45pm, we have an ABBA tribute show, ABBA Forever. I'm not sure actually if that's the name of the band or the name of their concert. But anyway, it's ABBA's music, and all tickets are £24.50. And we have another tribute show called Goodbye to Love, and this is The Carpenter's Story, and that's going to be on Saturday the 28th of March, 7:30pm, all tickets £27.50. Yet another tribute band, Rumours of Fleetwood Mac, who are on their 50th anniversary tour. I can't work out whether that's 50th anniversary of Fleetwood Mac. No, it's not, is it? Because Fleetwood Mac started earlier than that. So it's the 50th anniversary of a tribute band. Amazing. And they'll be performing on Sunday the 29th of March at 7:30pm. Tickets for that are £36.60 or £26.50. Then we have the Electric Swing Project on Friday the 3rd of April at 7:30pm. And this is where the 1920s meet the 2020s in an unforgettable night of dance, circus and electro swing music. Tickets for that are all £22. Then we have on Saturday the 4th of April at 7:30pm a show called Calling Planet Earth, and this is a romantic symphony that goes on a journey through one of the world's great musical eras, 1980s. Oddly enough, the one group that isn't billed as being tributed is where the title comes from, which is of course the Carpenters. Anyway, now we have another tribute band, Bootleg Beatles, and the show is called The Beatles on the Road. That's on Tuesday the 7th of April, 7:30pm, tickets £35 or £32.50. Thursday the 9th of April, 7:30pm, David Baddiel is doing a one-man stand-up comedy show entitled Trolls Not the Dolls. All tickets for that are £27. Then we have a performance of Mike Oldfield's Tubular Bells, but not by Mike Oldfield, of course. That is going to be on Saturday the 11th of April at 7:30pm, all tickets £25. Then we have The Greatest Hits of Motown, a show entitled How Sweet It Is. That's on Sunday the 12th of April, 8pm, all tickets £25. Then the last one at the arena is going to be The Tiger Who Came to Tea, and that's going to be on Tuesday the 14th of April through to Thursday the 16th, with performances mostly in the afternoon, and all ticket prices are £14. Now, we've rather surprisingly only got two events on at the Harveston Public Halls. On Wednesday the 8th of April at 2pm, we have a show called Exciting Science, and I think that's probably more aimed at children than adults. Then on Saturday the 11th of April at 7:30pm, we have Roy Ayers in a concert simply called Ubiquity. I haven't got the ticket prices for those, I'm afraid. Now, you also just got one event at the Abbey Theatre, over and above the one I previewed early by the St Albans Chamber Opera. And that's another musical event, in fact. It's running from the 2nd to the 4th of April, 7:30 p.m. on all those 3 days, and a Saturday matinee at 2:30 p.m. And the musical is Soysicle the Musical, and it's based on the stories of Dr. Seuss, with lyrics by Lynn Ahrens and music by Stephen Flaherty. Now, drama at the Maltings. And we'll kick off with what I think I previewed last month, but a reminder, it's got quite a long run. From the 12th through to the 21st of March, there is a performance of 39 Steps. And this is done by a cast of four, performing 40 roles. As I said before, I have seen it, and it is absolutely brilliant. Tickets are priced at £13.50 down to £7.50. And the performances are on the 12th, 13th, and 14th. Then there's a break until the 18th, and then they're on the 19th, 20th, and 21st. Then we have a play called The Unremarkable Death of Marilyn Monroe. And this is a one-woman show performed by Lizzie Wirt, who is from the Royal Shakespeare Company. And that's going to be on the 16th and 17th of March at 8 o'clock in the evening. And I suspect it's a similar price to the others. But actually, thinking about it, that explains why there was a gap in the performances for 39 Steps. They've got to fit Marilyn Monroe in. Now, a very different play, The Regina Monologues. This is performed by Rebecca Russell and Jenny Wafer, and it's about the plight of 16th century women. It's on the 24th through to the 28th of March, on all of those days. It's 8 p.m. on all the days. Ticket prices are £13.50 or £11. Now, the Hats Off Comedy Club makes a welcome return, and they're in the Homewood Road United Reformed Church on the 28th of March. Doors open at 7 p.m. The show is at 8 p.m. and all tickets are £20. Now, a couple of lecturers events to catch up with. On Wednesday, the 25th of March at 7:30 p.m, the Fleetville Diaries, and they meet in the Fleetville Community Centre on Hatfield Road. Fleetville Diaries has a talk by John Mean on the straw hat industry in St Albans. That is, say, 7:30, and it's free to members of Fleetville Diaries, or you pay £4 if you want to attend as a guest. The SAHAS has a lecture on the 17th of March, Coffee, A Global History. This is delivered by Professor Jonathan Morris, who is from the University of Hertfordshire, and it will tell you everything you wanted to know about coffee, how it started in Ethiopia and current coffee culture we enjoy today. Then Tuesday was, sorry, I should have said 7:45, Marlborough Road Methodist Church. All three of the lectures are in the same place at the same time. Tuesday the 7th of April, there's a lecture entitled Making a Mint by Mark Landon, and this is about late Iron Age coin production in the Thames area and further afield. And lastly, on Tuesday the 14th of April, we have a talk by SAHAS's very own president, Sandy Walkington, entitled Migration, Food and the St Albans Experience. And this talk is actually showcasing the research he has been doing and has submitted for his MA at the University of Hertfordshire. Now, lastly, two outdoor events. The first may be more of a warning than a preview. The Harpenden Street Festival takes place from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. on the 22nd of March. There'll be street performances, dancing, music and workshops. I just hope it stops raining by then. Then what used to be the Residents' First Weekend, which has been rebilled as the Hearts' Big Weekend, that runs on the 4th and 5th of April. And so lots of venues will be open free of charge. Some of them as a ballot to get in, others you can just walk in. But with all the regular favourites, I'm afraid I haven't looked up a long list of buildings, but places like the Clock Tower and the Clarion Hotel and the Cathedral, all those sorts of places are often open then. So do check out more if you want to see some of these buildings. And that's it. I will be back talking to you about what goes on from mid-April onwards next month.
Last time we were talking, Stephen, about the monastery, the development of the monastery and what went on in there. And one of the things that emerged is that there's a tendency, as always, between different power structures, that the abbot and the people didn't always get on.
The abbot was the feudal lord of all the people living in this area. The abbey owned their land. They paid rent. He ran the jurisdiction. He had his own jail, which he could put you into if you didn't pay your taxes to him or you weren't sufficiently in agreement. So the abbot was your spiritual lord, but he was also your temporal lord, just as an earl or a duke might be elsewhere. The Abbot of St. Albans ruled St. Albans.
And did they also feel that he was actually living off them? Does he then get treated as if he's the one that's stealing from them?
Well, yes, because it has this kind of consciousness of, you could call it the very earliest form of socialism, starts to develop the idea that the wealthy control the production and the power and the money, and yet the workers have no share in that. That becomes one of the big challenges, and the abbot represents the wealthy. John Ball, supposedly the first English socialist, that great sermon that he preaches, which I always think is a really good challenge to the idea of why should the wealthy be wealthy and why should we be poor? He actually says, when Adam delved and Eve span, who was then the gentleman? In other words, we are all descended from workers. Why are you suddenly in control and we are not? He has a real knack, this preacher, John Ball. And as I say, many people call him the first English socialist. Mm-hmm. He becomes an important part of this story.
Let's just stick with the abbot. Here we are now in the 14th century, aren't we?
We are, yes. Yeah, but even from towards the end of the 13th century, the citizens of St. Albans are getting very restless. In 1274, there's a bit of a rebellion. And twice in the early 1300s, there are little rebellions against the abbey. And the abbey and the abbot usually manage to suppress them. And these rebellions take the form of trying to claim their own authority. So the people of St. Albans want to be citizens, not serfs. But they're serfs, really. They owe their feudal duties to the abbot. They claim citizenry, and the abbot suppresses it each time. One of the abbots took a seal that the citizens made. They wanted to say that they could make their own documents and seal them with their own seal. One of the abbots seized the seal of the citizens, melted it down, and attached it to the shrine of St. Alban as a little trinket, as a symbol of his power.
It's all right if you get away with it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, come 1381, we're going to talk now, they get closer and closer to not getting away with it.
The abbot was who? What was his name at this time?
The abbot in the period that we're approaching is Thomas de la Mer, the great abbot, who, the longest serving of all of the abbots of St. Albans. He is appointed abbot in 1349, which means that he was abbot for 30 years, even before the big trouble starts. And he carries on, abbot, right up to 1396.
And from the church's viewpoint, was he a good abbot? I don't mean good in terms of being nice, but was he effective? He must have done something right to stay there that long.
He was regarded as a man who was tough, and you needed abbots who could govern well. But he was also regarded as a man who had true religion as well. Some of the abbots, if you look at the chronicles of St. Albans Abbey, the deeds of the abbots, some of the abbots get short shrift from the chroniclers. They're described as unholy men, only interested in power. Thomas isn't seen like that. Thomas has a spiritual side as well as a tough management side. He's almost in some ways, from the point of view of the monks, the ideal abbot. He cares for them. He cares for religion. But he also maintains his position and the abbey's power.
So there was a degree of concern, antagonism between him and the surrounding people.
And his predecessors. It had been building. It had been building for almost 100 years. Usually the abbey won, sometimes only after a bit of aggravation. But as time went on, things in the early 1300s were changing. I mean, England was going through changes. The Black Death had killed off a large number of the population. That meant that labourers could start demanding higher wages because there were fewer of them. So where labourers were employed, there was a sense in which they started to feel they had some power. There's the rumblings of the Lollards. The Lollards are a kind of religious movement who are against hierarchy in the church. John Ball, who we already mentioned, very much in the Lollard tradition. So there is this sense of change sweeping. And then come the middle of the 1300s, the crops start to fail. You have several years of poor harvests. So people have always been angry. They've been building up their resentment, and now they're angry, resentful, and hungry. And that is one of the factors that means that when the tax that the king wants to introduce, what we might call a poll tax, is introduced, they say, no, we're not having this. And there is a rising up against authority.
We've got two bands of authority, if you like. There's the church, and then there's the king and the state.
And they are two bands, but remember that they're very heavily worked into each other, so that the abbots of St. Albans are advisors to the kings. The kings of England all come on pilgrimage to St. Alban and the monastery. So there's a close alliance between the church and the state. Sometimes it falls apart. Think of Becket and Henry II. You know, sometimes it fragments. But more often than not, the two are very much in support of each other.
And what was this tax then?
So it's a taxation, basically, to try and levy funds, raise money, which is deemed to be unfair because it seems to be a flat rate tax on the whole population. And again, you know, the poor are saying, well, why are we paying the same as the wealthy? You know, it's the thing that we've seen several times in English history, including in the 1980s, not just the 1380s. And so there is this resentment that builds up. There are other resentments, too. I mean, there are several factors you can point. But people seem to reach a boiling point in the summer of 1381.
Discontent is badly handled by the authorities. It usually gets worse.
Yes.
Before, for them, it gets better.
It does, yes. And we have these three intense days in June 1381. So the 14th, 15th and 16th of June. Things happening down in Blackheath in London and things happening here in St. Albans in our local area. And the two are kind of related to each other. I might be able to show you that as we talk a bit further.
It's called the Peasants' Revolt, is what we're talking about. As far as one knows, is it organised across the country, or was it, there were pockets like Blackheath?
There were pockets, but definitely there were rebellions across the country. And I think once news got from one place to another that the serfs, the peasants, were revolting in some areas, then others rose up. So there was a sense of, well, if they can do it, we can do it. And if you do that in microcosm here in Hertfordshire, the same thing happens. The citizens of St. Albans, or sorry, the serfs of St. Albans who want to be citizens, rise up. But then it starts happening in other bits of the Abbey's lands throughout Hertfordshire as well. So there's a sense of taking courage from each other. And of course, it really culminates down in Blackheath on the 14th of June, 1381, when there is a huge massive of rebels who have come into London from several counties, including some from Hertfordshire. So some people from Hertfordshire go down to Blackheath, and there is this confrontation between the rebels and the king. And it's really interesting that Abbot Thomas de la Mare, the abbot we're talking about, he actually lets some of his servants go down and join the rebels. What was he doing? Were they spying? Were they going to come back and tell him what had really gone on? Or is he letting his servants go to make sure the rebels are out of St. Albans and away from St. Albans? It's almost like, okay, well, it can be bad down in Blackheath. As long as it's not bad on my turf, everything's fine. So on that 14th of June down in Blackheath, there are some abbey officials mingling amongst the peasants.
Was the intention of the revolutionaries to march on London from Blackheath, or was that where they just wanted to set up a camp and then...
What they really wanted to do was to talk to the king and get concessions from the royal house. And so that's what Richard II is ultimately forced to do. The rebels do get the upper hand for 24 or 48 hours. Remember that there are two significant executions. They do seize people and execute them. The two most significant ones are the king's legal officer, the treasurer of the court. He's executed.
Does he raise the tax?
Indeed. And the other one is the Archbishop of Canterbury, Simon Sudbury, who is beheaded by the crowds. This is all pretty horrific for England to see the Archbishop be beheaded. And so the young Richard II, who's only a boy, teenager, rides out to talk to the rebels. Wat Tyler, who is the great spokesman, probably the most articulate and organised. That's the key thing about Wat Tyler. He seems to be a highly organised revolutionary. They do say that's why Lenin succeeded, didn't he? Because he was really good at organising. Wat Tyler's like that. He has a clear plan of what to do, and he devolves certain actions to certain people. Anyway, Wat Tyler and Richard II talk together, and Richard makes concessions to Wat Tyler, and those concessions are then very rapidly, the news of those concessions are taken back into other places in England. And on the night of the 13th, 14th, people scurry back to St. Albans to tell Abbot de la Mare what has happened down at Blackheath.
Had they done anything locally? Like, had they attacked the abbey by that stage, or were they just hanging
there? There was a lot of pushing against the fences and trying to pull down the walls. But that gets much worse on the 15th of June, because once the news has arrived that the rebels are kind of in control in London and that the king has had to submit to the rebels' demands, then back in St. Albans, they get very, very excited. They go and meet in the woods. Remember, the abbey owned the woods and the land in the area today round about where Cunningham Hill is. And they capture a poor little rabbit as a symbol of, we can hunt on the abbot's lands if we want. and they put this rabbit on a pike and they carry it into the centre of St. Albans, where the pillory is, the place where people were punished by the abbot. And they put this rabbit on this pike as a symbol of their power. Now you see, we caught an animal on your land and you can't touch us. And then things do start getting nasty, and there's a real debate about whether the abbot should go and talk to these rebels or whether he should hang back. Some of the monks have already fled, by the way. Number two, the prior, and some of the monks have taken a tail and gone up to Tynemouth, back up to... Whenever things get bad in St. Albans, people go up north, away to the daughter house at Tynemouth Priory. And the prior and some of the monks had already left. They probably heard their names being muttered by the crowd. That's my suggestion. You know, we'll get so-and-so, we'll get so-and-so. Because remember, Caddington, one of the leaders of this rebellion, had been brought up in the monastery. He's called a son of the monastery. So in some way, he'd received care or attention or support from the monastery. So he probably knew the personalities of some of these monks. He probably knew which ones were truly unkind people. And some of them felt marked. So Dillamed does decide to go down and talk to the rebels. He does decide to go and negotiate with them. And the monks, you know, describe that as him being gracious and saving their necks by being willing to do that. That's how the chronicle describes it. And again, things don't always go well because the rebels meet Delamere at the great gateway, at the entrance to the abbey, and they start demanding things from him. And he can't provide what they demand, because what they demand is a charter. We have to think of this in legal terms. A charter was a written document proving something. And the citizens or the rebels in St. Albans believe that there was a charter in the abbey's annals in the library somewhere that proved that they could be free of the abbot, that proved that they could hunt on his land if they wanted. And they believe that the abbey had suppressed this charter and hidden it away. And so they turn up and they demand from Abbot Thomas, go and get us the charter. We demand it. We know what it looks like. It's got red and blue decoration across the top. Who knows where that detail comes from, but that's what they believed. And Thomas says, oh, well, I don't know any such charter. Wait here and I'll get my monks to look for it. And there's a bit of muttering. You know, the rebels say, well, we'd like to look for it ourselves. But he must have had a certain amount of personality to face them down, because the rebels don't actually invade the abbey and go looking for this charter. They let the monks scurry about. This is on the afternoon of Saturday, the 15th of June. And nothing can be produced. No, there is no charter. Was there? Is Thomas suppressing something that was really there? Who knows? There's no evidence that there was such charter. And so it's a very unresolved day. And I think Thomas does the classic little stroke of managing the crowd. He has to come out towards sunset and say, we cannot find a charter, but look, here's some bread and beer for you. Fill their stomachs. Give them some beer, because people drank beer anyway. Maybe you didn't drink water. Water was a nasty thing and you'd have died if you drank the water. But even so, feed the crowd, you know, get them hopefully sufficiently focused on that and not their demands, and everything will be all right. That's the concern that everybody has. That's how the night of Saturday the 15th finishes, with the rebels still at the gates, but not yet invading the abbey itself.
Does he know what's going to happen the next day? Does anybody know what's going to happen?
Not really, because, again, messages from London are coming not thick and fast. Sometimes when they arrive very suddenly and something startling happens. It was a bit like, what was the next bit of news from London going to say? So Sunday, the 16th of June, dawns, and two interesting messages come from London. The first is that Wat Tyler, the leader of the rebellion, the one who has wrung these concessions from the king, has been murdered. Some of the king's men turn on Tyler and kill him. And that works two ways. It disheartens some rebels and it enrages other rebels. So that's going on. And then a letter comes, basically a letter from Richard II, the king, saying to the Abbot of St. Albans, whatever the rebels want, give them. So they've got these two slightly conflicting messages. Thomas is hearing, first of all, the rebels have suffered a terrible defeat. Their leader has been killed. But the king is saying to me, give the rebels what they want.
As is traditional, there was dissent within the royal party.
Absolutely.
Some that were ignoring the king.
Yeah. And maybe that second message was sent before Wat Tyler was killed. You know, the messages arrive in the wrong order. Who knows? But clearly there is this, so how are we going to manage this situation? So basically what happens is Abbot Thomas says to the rebels in St. Albans, I cannot find your charter. And the rebels say, we'll dictate you a charter. And I can imagine these poor clerks probably quaking, you know. Here you've got the abbot of St. Albans, you've got the clerks, the scriveners and the clerks, and you've got the rebels saying, write this down. This is what you have to write down. And these demands start coming from the crowd, and Abbot Thomas commands them to be written up as a charter, which he seals with his seal at the end, saying that I will make you these four promises. And there are four promises he makes to the rebels at St. Albans, which really quietens them down.
And what are those?
So those four promises are very typical of the kinds of things which for the past 100 years have been causing aggravation. The first one is that the people of St. Albans want the absolute right of free passage, so movement, freedom of movement, pasture to be able to feed their cows, and hunting rights on abbey lands.
Those lands were quite extensive. And quite extensive. Were a dominant part of the community.
Virtually the whole of the south of Hertfordshire is abbey lands at that point. And so they want the freedom to access these lands without restriction and to profit from them and to feed themselves. The second one is the right of fishing in certain waters. And I think in our last programme we talked a little bit about the fish pools and how the people of Kingsbury had wanted to steal from the fish ponds and the fish pools. Well, this is one of the demands now. The right of fishing in certain abbey waters, and there is a list of which waters they're allowed. The third one is an old grievance that has gone a long way back in St. Albans, and that's the citizens want the right to mill their own corn. The abbey controlled the only legal mill in St. Albans, and if you had corn, if you grew corn, you had to take it to the abbot's mill and pay a fee to have it milled. And in fact, the abbot then took a small share. I mean, that's what the fee was. Some of the corn was taken by the abbey for their own purposes. And this was hugely resented, that you had to go to the abbot's mill, roughly where the Fighting Cocks area is today. And the citizens of St. Albans had, in the past, had handmills in their own houses, small, they're called querns, and you could mill your own corn in your own house. One of the previous abbots had seized all of the handmills of St. Albans and used them to pave the floor of his parlour. Quite nasty, really, quite nasty.
Walking on the freedoms
of your serfs. So that was the third demand, that they wanted the freedom of having their own handmills. And the final one, it's the most important one. It's interesting, most important comes last. And is that because it should be, or is it just because, and another thing, and oh, and yes. And this oh, and yes is they want the right of self-government. They want to have, in effect, a town council, an elected body representing the citizenry of St. Albans. They want to be citizens, not serfs. And as a symbol of that, what they'd done the previous day, in fact, was break into the abbot's jail and free the prisoners, but executed one of them. I feel sorry for the one that got executed, because basically he was being made an example of. They were saying to the abbot, we are in control of the prison now. We'll set these men free. And to show you we have power, we'll kill this one. So these are the four big demands. The freedom to feed yourself, to fish, the freedom to grind your own corn, a symbolic freedom, and the very important freedom of self-government.
And so everything ended happily.
Absolutely. It was all lovely. The abbot signed this. The king had said it should be done. They took the deeds off to the town cross, the market cross, and they read it out as a great proclamation to the citizens of St. Albans. The abbot has agreed to all our demands, and everything is fine for a couple of weeks.
Yes, then.
And then, on the 28th of June, so this, remember, this reading of the proclamation is the 16th of June, so less than 2 weeks later, the royal commissioners arrive, they arrest the leaders, people like Grindcobb and Caddington and so on, and they jail them at Hertford, and they start setting up a court system, a royal court, which will hear and try the rebels.
And is this for treason? What's the sort of
yes, in effect,
here?
Yes. So they're they've rebelled against the King's Majesty. Yeah. And also that they have committed murder because they have executed people. So there are a whole host of things. That trespass, you know, you name it. There'll be a whole range of charges that were brought against them. That happens on the 28th of June. The King's commissioners arrive. On the 15th of July, people start being brought for serious trials. And the most significant one here is the man we've mentioned so far, John Ball, the preacher, the first English socialist. He's brought before the king. Richard II is present in St. Albans with his treasurer, who's now Sir Robert Tresilian, the new treasurer, the new legal officer. And John Ball is executed on the 15th of July here in St. Albans as a symbol to the whole nation about what will happen to you if you rebel. And then others later on are brought forward. Actually, the king is quite clear that he will hang some, but let most go. So there's an element of warning, but also an element of mercy. And it's interesting because if you look at what the rebels had been saying all along, they were looking to the king as a good source and fountain of mercy and judgment. The crown is seen as a source of mercy and judgment. So what happens is there are about 80 rebels in Hertfordshire. Only 15 of them are hanged. So a relatively small number are finally executed. Most are allowed to go back to their homes. Some are in prison for a time. They do suffer punishments. I'm not pretending the king was merciful, but he decides not to carry out a slash and burn kind of approach to the population. But he does do something very grim with some of the bodies in St. Albans. Basically, he says that the bodies should be hung from gibbets in the marketplace and left there as a symbol of his power. And actually, in the night, the townspeople, probably relatives, go and take the bodies of these executed men and bury them. And Richard, the next day, makes them dig up the bodies and put them back. And they hang there for months and months and months. And the market square, the town centre of St. Albans, would not have been a pleasant place in late 1381, 1382, with these dead, decomposing people hanging there.
Lovely.
Yeah, a real, I am merciful, but I am also firm, and I am king.
Stephen, thank you very much indeed.
You're welcome.
The 2020 March edition of Primary has now come to an end.